Welcome to In the Garden with UC Master Gardeners. I am Katrina Kirkaby, and I'm here with Tina Spindler, and we are your co-hosts today of the January program of In the Garden. But first, I need to let everybody know that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management of KUCI or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show, go to kuci.org. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Greetings, Tina. It is January.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Oh, my goodness. The year is starting amazing. I hope everybody had a happy and joyous holiday season, and the new year is starting off just right for everybody.
Yeah, and we're going to give you some tips today on how to get your garden's new year to start off right.
Indeed, indeed. It's January. Where do you want to start, Tina?
Well, I think if anyone has gardened for any length of time, they think of January as bare root month. And so I think we should start with that because it is a great time to plant bare root plants. And for any listeners who are somewhat new to gardening and don't know what that term means, it just means that for deciduous plants, and that means plants that go dormant in the wintertime, lose their leaves, and quit having active growth, it is possible to dig those plants up out of the ground and shake off the soil and sell them bare root. That just means their roots are bare of soil. So growers grow fruit trees, deciduous fruit trees, and roses, and this time of year in the winter will harvest them by digging them out of the ground, packing the roots in wood shavings or peat moss, putting that into a plastic wrap, and shipping it to nurseries. And then instead of buying a plant in a pot already growing, you have what looks like these little dead sticks in a plastic bag. But actually, it's a miracle waiting to happen, because when you unwrap it and soak the roots for a bit in a bucket of water and dig and prepare a wonderful hole, you can plant this rose bush or this deciduous fruit tree, and in a couple of months, or in California maybe even a couple of weeks, because we don't really get much cold weather in Southern California, you'll see new growth sprouting out of the canes on the rose or the branches on the tree. But the best thing about planting bare root is that it is so much cheaper than buying already plants planted in a container. They're usually close to half price if you buy a bare root plant.
And don't you also, if you buy bare root, usually have more choices?
Oh my gosh, so many more choices, because think about it. You know, if you're a nursery and you have to plant these rose bushes in 5-gallon or bigger pots, you know, how many of those pots can you have standing in a 10-foot row? You know, you're limited. But if you have these bare root, you know, little canes sticking out of a root ball that's been wrapped in plastic, they actually can just stack those kind of on top of one another on a shelf. And so they can literally carry hundreds of these bare root roses or bare root fruit trees, as opposed to having each of those plants planted in its own container. So the beauty of it is that you can have a much bigger selection, and you can pay less money. And personally, I've had better luck with avoiding transplant shock if I plant bare root, because you're planting them when they're dormant, so they aren't going to, you know, be shocked in their growth cycle.
I've had the same experience too.
Yeah.
And also, I find that, you know, I'm not quite as young as I used to be, and carrying those big pots around are harder. And getting bare roots is a lot easier on my back.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. It's a lot easier for me to manipulate. If I'm planting, you know, a 5-gallon plant, then I have to, you know, beg and plead with my husband to help me lug that thing around.
Exactly.
Whereas a bare root plant, I can manage completely on my own.
You know, I think if people have never tried bare root and they're thinking about either planting a rose or planting a fruit tree, that it's something I'd really, really advise to go check it out. Not that you have to do it, but there's just so many benefits of bare roots. I mean, like you said, the cost, the ease, they tend to take off better.
Right.
And the choices. I mean, the choices of the roses you can get.
Oh, my gosh.
Or the fruit trees you can get.
The only thing that I have noticed, though, is that fewer and fewer nurseries are selling bare root roses. they often are selling them now in these little peat pots. And I think the reason is that in the nursery business, you know, for people to get excited about something that kind of looks dead, which is what the bare root plants look like because they're just sticks. Is tough for people who aren't experienced gardeners to get excited about that. And so the retail nurseries have gone to planting them not in big pots but in these little peat pots that you theoretically can just drop the whole pot in the ground because it's made out of a material that decomposes. But personally, I have gone to ordering bare root roses online from catalogs.
Really?
Because, again, I mean, you know, you can go to nurseries and buy them in the peat pots. There's absolutely nothing wrong with doing that. But, again, because of the space considerations, you know, the nurseries can only carry so many different varieties because they only have room for so many of those pots. Whereas if you do order online, then you have, gosh, so many selections if you buy direct from the growers.
And it's fun. I mean, it's fun to look at online what's out there and the varieties. Oh, my goodness.
Well, the thing I like, you're right, Katrina, the thing I like about the information that's online is for every variety, they will have, you know, this full page that will tell you how tall the plant gets. You know, is it a rose bush that stays between 3 and 4 feet, or is it a rose bush that gets up to 6 feet tall? Is it a rose bush that grows kind of in a columnar shape, or is it a rose bush that spreads 5 feet wide? You know, all things you need to know before you choose one for that spot in your garden. You may not have room for, you know, a plant that grows, you know, 6 feet tall and 5 feet wide. You may want a rose that grows, you know, 3 feet wide and 4 feet tall. And then, of course, it tells you whether it's scented. It tells you whether it's a certain kind of variety. But I'm not going to get in too much to the details about roses because we have an awesome show coming up later this month with our friend and amazingly knowledgeable master gardener, Kay Havens, who Katrina and I both love.
Oh, we're both Kay Havens fans. Yeah. And you guys are going to be talking about...
We're doing an entire show on roses. So we're going to tell you about all the different kinds of roses. We're going to tell you how to plant them, how to choose them, how to prune them, and how to just care for them in regards to feeding, pest and disease, and so forth. So we're going to do a whole show on that. So I'm going to kind of...
You know what, I think we're going to put off telling you any more about roses, but right now might be a good time to tell people if there's a subject that you want to hear more about, you can go to our website, and everything that we've been talking about for the last several years is on our website. So you can go, if there's another topic you want to hear about, you can go to our website and check it out and just listen to whatever podcast. If you happen to miss the one with roses with Tina and Kay, you can go to our website and check that out. And good stuff.
Anytime. Yeah, we have a whole library of every show that we've ever done. So I'll give you our website so that you know where to go because it's actually a new web address for us. And it is mgorange, O-R-A-N-G-E, no spaces, .ucanr.edu. And it is a long address, so if you can't remember all of that, just Google University of California Master Gardeners of Orange County, California, and you'll find the link to our website. And once you get to the website, you can look for the radio show tab. Click on that, and then you will see an alphabetical listing of all of our shows. So you can, you know, if you want to go back and learn about one of the topics that we've talked about in the past, they're right there for you to play.
Or if there's something that we talk about today and you said, what did they talk about? I can't quite remember what they said. It'll be posted, and just go listen to it again.
Just what you want. Tina and Katrina in your car while you're vacuuming.
You know, we do have a lot of people that listen to this as they're doing housework. I've been told. We have no ego. This is good.
Listen
as you learn. Right?
Yes, exactly.
Or work as you learn.
So anyway, to conclude on roses, since we're not going into a lot of detail, buy bare root this month, plant the bare root plants, and we're going to talk about planting bare root fruit trees in a minute, and the process is pretty much the same for roses. And then dormant spray your roses after you prune them. And we're going to talk about that with regard to fruit trees. Process is quite similar. So moral of the story is tune in again for the Rose Show later this month. And now, should we move to bare root fruit trees?
Ooh, yeah.
As long as we're talking.
It's that time of
bare
year.
Bare root, yeah. So the other plant that is typically planted, or class of plants that are planted bare root this time of year, are deciduous fruit trees. So those would be the trees like apples, peaches, apricots, plums, pluots, apriums, all of those crosses of deciduous fruit trees. And the reason you buy them is the same way you, same reason you buy roses bare root, is that they are so much cheaper. And I like, especially for fruit trees, Katrina, because they get taller in the pots. As you said, moving those big pots is a lot of work.
Yeah.
And imagine moving a fruit tree, which isn't just, you know, 3 feet tall. It could be, even in a pot, it can be 6-7 feet tall, right?
Exactly.
But if you buy a bare root one, they're usually a little bit smaller. And, of course, they're not heavy because they don't have any soil around them.
You know, and if you go and look and find something that says bare root, and you're going to say, what was Tina and Katrina talking about? I'm going to buy this stick. That stick is a treasure. You just, it is wonderful. It grows quickly. Don't worry about it. It grows fast. And you will have a beautiful fruit tree in not a very long period of time at all.
It's true. It doesn't look like much now, but there's a big surprise waiting inside of it. So.
I remember the first time I saw one, I said, are you kidding me? How stupid do I look?
Yeah. Seriously? I'm going to plant a stick?
And I'm going to pay money for this stick.
Yeah.
Right? I didn't know anything about gardening. What can I say? So don't be put off by how it looks.
Right. And then let's give you a few tips on how to plant bare root fruit trees. We do have a fruit tree show in our archive. So to hear more about this, you can go to the website and look up that show. But I will tell you briefly how you want to plant a bare root fruit tree. First of all, you want to dig a hole that is about 2 feet wide by about 18 inches deep. And one of the ways you can tell how deep it should be is when you unwrap that bare root fruit tree and you look at the roots, you can see how long those roots extend. They'll usually extend anywhere from 12 to 18 to maybe 2 feet long. And what you want to do when you unwrap it is you want to trim off any broken roots, and you want to trim off any roots that are obviously shriveled and look dead. They're pretty easy to tell. They're black. They just, you know, they don't look alive. And then I like to fill a bucket of water with a bucket full of water while I'm preparing the hole, and let the fruit tree soak in that while I'm digging the hole. And you want to amend your hole, if you have clay soil, with a little bit of compost. If you have really good soil, you don't need to amend it. And then you want to make a cone out of that excavated soil back in the hole. And that, you can picture the cone being the support for those roots that are going to be spread out over that cone of soil inside the hole. And I know it's radio, so it's kind of hard to see.
Kind of think of it as a traffic cone.
There
you
go.
What you're going to do is put your bare root that's on top of the traffic cone and let all the roots go on the sides of the traffic cone.
Good visual. Yeah, really good visual. And then you're going to backfill the hole. And, of course, this usually kind of takes two people because, you know, the tree has nothing holding it up. So you need one person to hold the tree while the other person is putting the soil back in. And also the person holding the tree is going to have to adjust the height of that tree a little bit as the soil is being backfilled, because you'll see on your fruit tree that it has been what's called grafted. And that means that there will be a little bump that's probably about 4 inches or so above where the roots come out. And that bump is where a graft has occurred. And a graft means that that a desirable variety of fruit has been, a small branch has been cut off of that variety. And it has been then attached to a plant that was grown specifically just for its roots. Because some plants have very sturdy roots and not very tasty fruit, and other plants have weak roots but really tasty fruit. So the way that you get around that, so that you have a very healthy plant with very tasty fruit, is you take the two of them and you graft them together. And that's a whole nother talk about how that process happens. But suffice it to say, you'll be able to see where the graft is by a little bump on the bottom of the trunk. You want that bump to be above the soil level. So you do not want to bury that bump. And the reason for that is if you do bury it, then what will happen is that rootstock will start sending up its own trunk, and that will produce the fruit that isn't very tasty. And what you want is the fruit that is tasty, so you don't want to let that rootstock start to bear branches that will produce fruit that is undesirable. The other thing to remember is that you do not want this tree to be planted in a sunken hole. So at the end of your planting endeavor, you want to make sure that that soil that the tree has been planted in is actually maybe an inch or two above the surrounding soil. And the reason is that soil that you've backfilled is loose and crumbly, right? And as you water it, it's going to collapse. And that could end up having your tree sink in a hole. And why that's bad is because then that depression will fill up with water when you get irrigation or rainwater, and that can cause disease problems if that moisture is up against the trunk of that tree. So make sure that your level of the tree is a couple of inches above the surrounding soil and that your graft union is a couple of inches above of that. So anyway, hopefully you can visualize that. I know it's radio, so it's a little bit tough. And then after you do that, you want to take some soil and make what we call a watering well. So you want that watering well, which is a ridge of soil made in a circle, you want that to be under the drip line of the tree, a little bit out from the drip line. So what's a drip line? So a drip line, Katrina's looking at me like, you got to tell them what a drip line is. I can tell from the look in her eye. So the drip line is where the little branches are, because your bare root tree will have branches. They won't have anything on them, no leaves or anything.
They might only have a couple, few branches.
Yeah, might only have 3, 4, 6, whatever. But where the edge of those branches are, where the water would come down when it hit the end of one of those branches, that's called the drip line. And so you want your watering well of soil, that ridge of soil, to be right outside the drip line, so that you irrigate and the water stays at that brand new planted root zone and doesn't run off, you know, out into the gutter or someplace in the yard. But you do want it at the drip zone because you don't want that water to congregate up against the trunk. You want it to go out to the edge of the drip line, because that's where the new roots that absorb food and water are going to be the most active.
And you want your roots to be going out, so you want to have them drawing outwards
towards the water,
back into the tree.
Yeah, exactly. And then after that, you just need to make sure that you water this young fruit tree regularly. And so I like to fill up that watering basin, let it drain completely, and then a little while later go back and fill it again, just so that I can make sure. Because remember, you just dug a hole that's probably 18 inches deep, and you want that water to go all the way down to the very bottom of those roots. So that's how you plant a fruit tree. And then, you know, hopefully you'll, in a couple of years, fruit trees don't usually produce the first, you know, year or two, but in a couple of years you'll have some amazing peaches or apples or apricots or whatever you decided to plant. It's pretty fun.
I love having fruit trees.
I do too.
If you've never had a fruit tree, have a fruit tree.
Yeah.
And I think my favorite, if I was only going to have, well, I don't know.
No, tell what your favorite is.
No, I can't.
You're afraid you're going to hurt their feelings?
Everybody's got a favorite, so go plant your favorite. But when you plant something, you know, some people have gone to the store and they found a plant or a tree and it was on sale and it's they bought it, but it's not really not their favorite.
Yeah.
You know, go spend a little bit of time and figure out what your favorite tree is and plant that one.
Well, the other thing that I do need to mention when you're choosing, I can't forget that.
I'm glad chill hours, big deal.
Glad you said spend some time choosing. Yes, absolutely. And the reason you need to spend time choosing is because, remember, here in Southern California, it doesn't get very cold. And deciduous fruit trees need something that's called chill hours. And that's the number of hours at which they experience temperatures below 45 degrees. they need chill hours in order to produce fruit. And the varieties that are grown on the East Coast, where they get whole winters where the temperatures are below 45 degrees, may not produce fruit here on the West Coast because we get a way limited number of chill hours. So the best way to tell whether it's the right kind of tree is to go to a nursery that has knowledgeable staff. And I now, you know, we have our smartphones. You should see me. I Google when I'm in a nursery, constantly Googling in the nursery. So you look at the tag if there isn't a knowledgeable person handy. You look at the tag and it says that it's an apple called Anna. You type in Anna apple and click on the internet and you'll get all kinds of information on that tree, part of which should include the number of chill hours and whether it's suitable for a low chill area. And Anna apple is suitable for a low chill area. The other thing you can do is you can go to davewilson.com, which is a premier grower of deciduous fruit trees. And one of our favorite people to interview is Tom from Dave Wilson. And he has given us some great podcasts. So you can go, again, on our website and listen to entire podcasts that will tell you all about chill hours and how to care for and plant fruit trees.
You know, one of the things I really like about his website is that when I wanted to plant some fruit trees, I can go there, and it was really easy to read. And I went down, and I looked at chill hours.
Yep.
And then I started with the least amount of chill hours of what I wanted, because some years we have less. We don't ever have a lot, but some years we have less.
We have, like, almost none.
Yeah. I mean, really less. But you can go on there and go, oh, I can get this, this, and this, and they all fit into the parameters. Now, sometimes there's a tree that you might really want, and you go there, and sure, you can plant it, but you may never get a piece of fruit off that tree. So, and I've done that, because I went, I really want this. You know, maybe it will be cold enough.
Because we're master gardeners, and we think we can fool Mother Nature or something.
Well, that was actually before I was a master gardener. I didn't know about chill hours. I just wanted a tree, a certain kind of tree. But, you know, if you just kind of follow the directions and listen to it a little bit, you can get a bumper crop of a lot of different trees that go really well here. I have about 40 fruit trees in my yard, and they produce. And it's really nice to get a tree that can produce. And there's
that
a lot of
trees. That gives you something.
Yeah, that gives you something. And there's so many trees within the chill hours that are for our area. You might not have that one that Grandma Sue used to have, but there's going to be other ones that work for our area. So it just word to the wise.
Yes.
Is make sure there's, you know, the fruit, the chill hours match our area.
Yeah, and because the interesting thing is Dave Wilson Nursery actually trials some of their varieties at the University of California Research Station, Agricultural Research Station here in Irvine. So that's kind of cool because then they publish their results on their website, and so you can actually know that those have been trialed in Southern California and, you know, believe what you're reading on that website.
And you set yourself up for success.
Exactly.
You know, in this time where we truly try to watch our water and we're really busy, and our lives are busy, and our gardening time could be limited, you want to plant something that's going to give you what you really want.
Yeah, and the other thing that's great about their website is they give you the information that you need about each variety. For instance, did you know there were early, mid, and late peaches? I didn't know that because I wasn't a master gardener yet and hadn't listened to Tom Spellman's talks yet in our training. And so I didn't know that I could plant three peach trees in the same hole, and I could have chosen an early, a mid, and a late peach, and I would have had peaches from June to September had I known that. Instead, I chose one peach tree. Fortunately, it was a low chill tree, but, you know, all my peaches come ripe in, you know, a few weeks. So that's a great website to learn about deciduous fruit trees. There's so much that we could tell you. In fact, we have done a whole show with Tom Spellman from Dave Wilson Nursery. So do look for the fruit tree show if you want to hear more.
And go to their website. A lot of good stuff.
Yeah.
And a lot of good stuff. Interesting things you might never have known about before.
And you'll love it when your fruit trees start bearing and giving you fruit to make jam and all kinds of good stuff out of. Peach pie.
Oh, I just sit under the tree and eat.
Oh, that's true.
On dehydratum and barbecue. Yeah. Oh.
But you're right. Under the tree with the juice dripping off your elbows is probably the best.
Oh, there we go again.
But I don't want to leave fruit trees quite yet because I do want to talk about dormant spraying. And this applies to roses as well. So dormant spray simply means spraying your trees or your roses, your dormant plants, with a spray, and there are several different kinds of sprays you can use, but it's called a dormant spray because you apply it when the plant is dormant. So you can, of course, if you have insects, you know, you may choose to spray, you know, later in the season when the plant is full of leaves and so on and so forth. But it's actually a really great preventive method of eliminating future problems or having less problems in the later season if you do a dormant spray in January. So what should you spray with? Well, it depends on the plant, of course. And there are two classes of dormant sprays. And one are the horticultural oils, and they basically are exactly what it says. They are oils. Some are organic and come from plant material like neem oil. And some are petroleum products, but they are oils and they work by smothering the bodies of overwintering insects. So how cool is that? You have a little bit of scale on a tree and you spray it with an oil and it smothers the scale and no more scale. And as opposed to if you didn't spray, that scale just continues to live. It may not be multiplying in the cold weather, but come spring and the warm weather, boom, you know, you'll have a bigger scale infestation. The other type of dormant oil are dormant oils that are preventive measures for fungal diseases. So they are fungal sprays. And one that is most commonly used is a lime sulfur spray. And it's actually qualifies as an organic method. And it controls insects and fungi and lots of diseases on deciduous fruit trees and berries and grapevines. And it is something that I personally use on my roses because, I don't know about you, Katrina, but I always get fungal diseases on the roses. Black spot, powdery mildew.
Powdery mildews are...
Yeah. And also sometimes I have scale, you know, on some of the rose bushes. So the nice thing about using the lime sulfur spray is it will help hopefully lessen the occurrence of those fungal diseases because you're at least smothering the spores that might remain on that tree. And also because the spray drops to the ground, you're smothering any spores that may be laying on the ground. So since I've started dormant spraying, which I started, gosh, I don't know, 8-9 years ago, I have had way less fungal disease on my roses than I ever did before that.
Well, you know, Tina, why don't you give us our little thing that we need to know, and then I have a question for you.
Okay. Is it time for us to do our station ID?
It is time to do the station
All
ID.
All right, let's do it. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. And the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management of KUCI or the UC Board of Regents. And for more information about this show, you can go to kuci.org.
There you go. Okay, so here's my question on roses, Tina.
Sure.
When we spray, is it better to spray before we do our January pruning or after our January pruning?
No, you always spray, because we haven't talked about pruning, because Kay and I are going to cover pruning of roses in detail, but you always spray after you prune. And you may also, for some of your fruit trees, want to do some pruning in the winter in January. And that is a topic for another show, because the pruning that you do for each plant is specific to that plant. So
the reason why I asked that question is because people might only hear this and not think about they might not hear the next show. So if you're not going to be hearing the next show about the roses and the pruning, go to our podcast, because we really should be doing some snipping and pruning and of these things before we put the spray on there.
Yes, you absolutely want to prune your roses and do any fruit tree pruning first and then spray for a couple of reasons. You know, if you spray first, well, you're going to be cutting off a lot of the plant, so you've wasted a lot of that spray, right? And then you're going to be handling those pieces of the plant that you took off. And so you're going to be getting residue of that spray on your gloves
and then
so
you're
on.
Not going to have get the whole if you already take the stuff off, you'll get a better coverage.
Right.
So just something to think about, and listen to Tina and Kay's show, and they'll tell you what to do, and you'll be able
in
to
detail.
Put all the pieces together.
But yes, prune first, clean up all the pruning, clean up all dead leaves before you spray. And the reason is remember, those fungal spores and those insects may be hiding on those pieces that you cut off or the leaves that have fallen on the ground. And our object with doing this spraying is to prevent fungal disease and kill as many of those fungal spores as possible and as many insects as possible so that we don't have problems later on in the season. So rake everything up before you spray. And that way, any fungal spores or insects that are left on the ground will have that spray fall upon them and hopefully, you know, destroy them, and then you won't have a lot of problems come spring. There's one more thing I need to talk about, though, quickly. A particular fungal thing that drives me particularly crazy, and that's peach leaf curl, because I have a peach tree. Do you get peach leaf curl?
Yeah.
And the reason I want to single this one out in particular is because you don't do a one-time spraying for this. You do at least a two-time spraying for this. And I know I was frustrated because I was spraying, you know, my peach tree, and I was still getting peach leaf curl. And then finally, I did some reading, and turns out you're supposed to spray twice. So for peaches, what you're supposed to do is you are supposed to spray with the lime sulfur spray, but you're supposed to do it as soon as they lose their leaves. Now, that happens sometimes in November and sometimes in December. Of course, we've already passed those times because this is our January show. So I'm going to give you another option. If you didn't spray the first time in late November or December, then go ahead and spray twice in January. You want to do it once early in the month, and then wait 2 weeks, and then do it a second time. And then also, do remember, whenever you use a dormant spray, if it rains within 2 days, within 48 hours of your spraying, you kind of have to start over again and pretend that you didn't do that first one, because it basically got washed off.
So what would make life easier is look at the weather report.
Before you spray?
Yeah.
Yeah, word to the wise. So yeah, do use dormant sprays. You'll be happy and have less work to do later in the season if you do.
You know, so much of gardening is if you do a little now, you save a lot later.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, before we leave fruit trees, can I talk about citrus for a minute?
Absolutely.
Okay. So now citrus are not deciduous, right? They're evergreen. They keep their leaves all the time, all year long. But they need to be fed a lot. They are what are called heavy feeders. And as we've talked about in some shows on fertilizers, we'll just briefly remind you that fertilizers have three main nutrients: nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And citrus trees need a lot of nitrogen. So you want to feed them for the first time in January, unless you live way inland where you have frost. Then you want to wait because we don't want to encourage new growth to be damaged by frost. But if you live in Orange County, most of Orange County is not subject to a lot of frost. So the reason that you want to feed in January is that the fruit trees often blossom, the citrus trees often blossom, orange trees in particular, in February. The navels. And if you give your tree a little food in January, you'll get a heavier blossom. And so what does that mean, of course? that means more fruit. So do get ready to feed your fruit trees for the first time in January, unless you live in a place where you think you're going to get some frost, and then wait until a little bit later, next month. Yeah. I should mention a little bit about fertilizing the fruit trees. The best thing to do, if you can, is to get, you know, the bag organic fertilizer that's labeled for citrus, because it will have the right ratio
or balance.
Yeah, for those, for that particular fruit trees. And also, it'll probably have some micronutrients that orange trees are particularly fond of. But the other thing that you want to remember, particularly if you're lucky enough to have inherited a mature citrus tree, you know, that someone who owned your home or planted, you know, before you did, you may have one of these, God, I love walking past these yards, you know, where the citrus canopy hangs over the fence and you just see this, you know, giant tree full of oranges. I'm so jealous of them, because my citrus trees are only 10 years old, so they're not ginormous like that. But if you do have a big one, especially, but this is true for any fruit tree, any tree actually, period, that you're going to fertilize. Again, remember that term drip line, where the edge of the canopy of the tree is, where the water would drip on the edge of the canopy. You want your fertilizer to be placed around the drip line. Think of a donut with a hole in the middle. And so where the trunk is the donut hole. You don't want any fertilizer up against the trunk. There's no feeder roots near the trunk. The feeder roots are out at the drip line and beyond the drip line. So you want to spread that fertilizer in a circle that begins a little bit inside the drip line and goes out, you know, from the drip line, maybe, depends on the age of your tree, but, you know, maybe 6 inches to a foot beyond the drip line. That way, your fertilizer will be soaking into the ground right where the feeder roots are, which is exactly who needs to get the food, is those feeder roots. Yeah. And then you can scratch it in a little bit, very gently, with a little cultivator if you want. And then, of course, water it in, you know, quite well. It's also a good idea to watch the weather forecast before you fertilize. Why not let the rain soak it in for you, you know?
I try to do that, too.
Yeah.
It just helps.
I know my husband always laughs at me, because, you know, I'll be out there at dusk when it's getting dark, you know, spreading fertilizer, and he'll say, oh, my gosh, you drive me crazy, you know? But I'm going, no, it's going to rain tonight. I have to get the fertilizer down.
So, I understand that.
So, another good thing to do this time of year that will result in great results for you later on.
Good going. Where should we go from here? Oh, how about vegetables?
Sure. Just briefly on vegetables. Yeah. Well, actually, yeah, we'll spend more time on seeds than on growing vegetables. But just briefly for vegetables, hopefully you planted your cool season veggie garden. If you did not, you can still do it in January. So lettuce, anything in the kohl family, like broccoli and cauliflower and Brussels sprouts, any of the root vegetables, onions,
great time to get onions. Order
bare root onions online if you can't find them in your nursery. But you want the bare root onions. Who knew that onions came bare root? But they do. You need short day onions. Those are the kind that we need in our latitude. If you don't get short day onions, they won't form a bulb. They'll just get to be big old fat green onions. So order short day onions so that you get the bulbing onions. And then in the rest of your garden, if you planted it like we were suggesting in late October or November or December, you should have lots of lettuce, lots of kale, hopefully some snap peas that you can harvest. And you just want to continue to harvest the outer leaves of the lettuce. Or if you have full heads and you want to harvest a whole head, you can harvest the whole head. And remember on the peas to keep them picked, because picking them stimulates more peas to come. And if you don't keep them picked, then the plant will think that it's kind of done. So keep those peas picked. And also give your veggie garden a little fertilizer, either through side dressing, which means in between your rows, you can sprinkle the granular fertilizer, or you can use an organic liquid fertilizer and, you know, water the fertilizer in using a liquid fertilizer. You always want to water well, no matter what kind of fertilizer you use. So make sure you give your veggie garden a good watering when you're fertilizing. Anything else, Katrina, that you do that I have forgotten to mention?
I still plant some stuff from Six Packs.
Okay, good.
You know,
good.
I can just keep planting a little bit every couple of weeks. That's the way we do it in our yard, just to keep adding so we get this rotating crop thing going. That's about it. Have a good time. Enjoy your yard.
Yeah. So let's move on, okay. Crazy as it seems, to warm season gardens. Yikes, in January?
Oh, and Tina, you are so good at this. Tina is the best. Okay, we're going to talk about warm season gardening.
Well, I think it's probably because I get bored, you know, and I just look forward to what I can do that is new.
Well, it's great.
And what you can do in January is you can drive your husband or your wife crazy by ordering lots of seed catalogs to fill up your mailbox. My husband goes, oh, my gosh, do we have to have more of these? But I tell him it's a cheap vice, right? They're free, first of all, and it entertains me for hours in the evening flipping through seed catalogs. And what you want to look for are all those really cool tomato varieties that you want to have this coming summer. And you want to think about that in January and order your seeds because you want to plant those seeds in containers, in little six packs, in the end of January and the beginning of February.
And you know what else is so nice is that you get the variety that you will never get if you buy them in a six-pack.
Yeah, if you want unusual peppers that are different colors or different shapes. Or
even kale.
Or different tomatoes. Of course, tomatoes, you know. You can have, there's an infinite, it seems like, number of tomato
types
varieties
of
out there.
Types of eggplants, types of peppers.
Yeah, just who knew eggplant came in pink, right?
Yeah.
So when you grow from seed, you have the opportunity to try all of these really fun, different things that you may not find in the nurseries.
And
although,
it's cheap. And it's cheap.
Oh, it's so cheap. And you also, believe me, will get way more seeds than you can use. So share with friends. I mean, one packet of tomato seeds, you know, you can probably split that among what? 3-4 people?
At least.
At least, yeah. Or start a whole bunch of them and then share the plants with your friends. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, do spend a little bit of time. We'll talk in February about, well, I guess we can talk briefly about it now. If you're real rambunctious and eager to get a jump on starting seeds and you want to do it in late January, I'll talk about it real briefly now.
Okay.
Best thing to do is to buy a bag of seed starting mix. It's a real fine soilless mixture that is finer than potting mix. You can use potting mix totally fine, but I like to get the seed starting mix because it's super fine and your little seeds have no problem poking their little heads, you know, through the mixture because it's so fine. It doesn't, you know, they're not going to hit any little pieces of wood or anything like that. Then the other thing you want to do is look at the back of your seed packet. It will tell you how deep to plant that seed. And you want to lay the seed on top of the soil that you have put in your six packs. You want to firm that soil a little bit before you put the seed on top of it because you don't want the soil to be so loose that it just collapses, you know, into nothingness. So firm it a little bit before you put the seed on top of it. And then if it says the seed is supposed to be planted in 1/8 inch deep, then take a handful of soil and sprinkle it on top until you've got 1/8 inch of soil on top of your seed. Gently tap it down so that the soil comes in contact with the seed. And then you're going to want to water it with a gentle spray, or you can put it in a container like a cake pan that has high sides, and or you can buy actually seed starting trays, right?
The seed starting trays are cheap and they're easy and they're the perfect size.
They're the perfect size.
And it won't rust out on you and get yucky.
And they also come usually with a domed lid, a clear plastic lid, and that is great because you put that on top while the seeds are germinating and it keeps the moisture inside. It's like a mini greenhouse. And if you have those seed starting trays, you can put water in the bottom of the tray, and then the little cell packs, which have holes in the bottom, will soak that water up from the bottom, and that's called bottom watering. So that's another way to water them. But you can also use a very fine spray or mist. Just don't use a strong stream of water because you'll dislodge your seeds. They'll go flying around, making a mess. Then you won't have any seeds in your little cell packs. Also, I did forget to mention, put more than one seed in each of the cells. You don't know if every single seed is going to germinate, so I like to put two or three seeds in each cell, and then if all three of them germinate, I just take a pair of nail scissors and I cut off the ones that are extra and just leave the strongest looking one there. But then you want to put them in a warm place. So in January, of course, you want to keep them indoors because it's not very warm outside. So I actually have purchased what's called a seed heating mat. It's always hard to say. And it's just like a heating pad, and you plug it in, and it just gets like gently warm. It doesn't feel barely warm to the touch. And you set your tray on top of that, and it gives it a little bottom heat, which helps them to germinate a little more quickly. But you don't need it. Just put it in a warm area. Top of the refrigerator is good, you know, it's kind of warm up there. You can put it in a window, but not one that gets direct sun, because you don't want, you know, the sun beating down on your little seeds.
Yeah.
And then once the seedlings get to a couple of inches high and send out a couple sets of leaves, you want to immediately transfer that to a warm area outside, or a brightly lit window, or put grow lights over it. Because if you don't give it adequate light, then you're going to get these really long, leggy plants that are not going to be very healthy for planting out in the garden.
Not very strong.
Yeah. So do for sure make sure that your little seedlings have a good source of light. If you do decide to put them out on your patio, you have a patio cover, so it's not going to get direct sunlight, that would be great. But remember, the nights are still cold in January and February, so if you put them outside during the day, remember to bring them in at night so they don't have that super cold exposure when they're tiny little babies. And then hopefully in 6 weeks, so about the beginning or mid-March, you'll have these nice, healthy transplants that you can go out and put in your yard.
Or give to friends, too.
Or give to friends, yeah. So look at those seed catalogs. Have fun.
Yeah. You should see Tina smiling right now.
Yeah, oh, gosh. Enjoy. I can't wait till I get my catalogs in January. Super, super fun.
Well, Tina, why don't we talk a little bit about, it's this time of year, we have some perennials that are out there that might need a little bit of grooming, trimming. Tell us about
that. Yeah, January is a great time to get your perennials tidied up. So one that I always try to get tidied up in January, February are my Mexican sage, because I have a lot of Mexican sage that I pair with white roses, so the purple and the white in the fall just looks so pretty. But they're done blooming, you know, by January, and they look a little lanky because the Mexican sage, you know, flower
gets big.
It's, you know, what, 4 or 5 feet tall, and they get a little droopy and so on, especially if we get rain. They get really droopy.
Oh, one rain in wintertime can drop them.
Yeah, flat. So that's not very attractive. So I like to take a look at them, because what they do is they send out new growth from the base of the plant, and we call that basal growth. And when that basal growth on those is, you know, 6 to 10 inches high, then I completely cut down to the ground those old long stems that flowered. And that then clears the way for the new growth to get more sunlight. And then it takes off, and gosh, in just a few weeks, it's, you know, a couple feet tall.
It's amazing. I mean, once you do, you see that coming up there, and once I sometimes hate cutting it back, but as soon as I cut it back, the new ones just take off. And it's that time of year where you're really not out in the yard all that much yet, and it's really not the warm. And so by the time spring comes, it's up and going already.
Yeah, it's just a great way to also, if not that the Mexican sage gets a lot of disease, but other perennials might, you know, have a little bit of scale or some pest that's going to try and overwinter on the old stems from the last year. So the other thing that's good is by cutting off those old stems and just leaving that new basal growth, you might be getting rid of some of, you know, pest and disease issues as well.
I also cut back some of my other plants too.
Yeah,
they've gotten a little, I leave them during the winter time because they're still looking good, but I don't want them maybe necessarily huge during the summer. So January, February, I do a lot of cut back, and then the days are starting to get longer and everything's starting to grow again. Yeah, and it comes back really quick.
Yeah, another one that is great to cut back is Buddleia. If you have any Buddleia, butterfly bush is the common name, and you want to cut those. You know, they get tall. You know, mine I think is 7 or 8 feet tall, and so I cut back all the stems that have bloomed there to, you know, 18 inches or so, and then you get a new flush of growth.
Now, do you cut it down or do you just cut it shorter?
I cut it shorter, so the Buddleias you don't cut all the way to the ground like you do the flowering fronds of the Mexican sage. And if you're ever, you know, afraid, you know, of what you need to do for each plant, just Google it or get the Sunset Western Garden book. It's everybody who gardens should have a copy of the Sunset Western Garden book, because for the most part, they will tell you for each plant, you know, when to trim it back and whether you cut it back down to the ground because it has new basal growth, or like in the case of the Buddleia, you just cut every branch back to like 18 inches and then it'll send up new growth from that height. In the case of the Buddleia, you don't want to cut it back all the way to the ground because...
How far down? I'm curious now. How far down do you cut
yours? I do mine between 12 and 18 inches.
Cut it back that far?
Yeah. On the Buddleia, you can see there'll be like little tiny new leaves, but like tiny. They won't look like the mother leaves, which are like, you know, maybe 4 inches long. These will just be like baby leaves. Mm-hmm. So I cut it down to where there looks like there's a real healthy pair of baby leaves. So if at 18 inches... the baby leaves aren't looking so hot, then I might go a little bit lower till I find a good set that looks like they'll really
take off.
Yeah. So, and then, you know, the other one that is good to cut this month so that you don't ruin its spring summer bloom is lavender. And we're planting a lot more lavender in California because it is a drought tolerant perennial, relatively drought tolerant. It's not, you know, you do have to give it some water, but it needs a lot less water than others. And if you cut those back, shape them and cut off, you know, the blooms that bloomed the last year and do that in January, then you haven't disturbed the bud formation for the coming up bloom. But if you prune them later, then you might be cutting off your new bloom for this year. So, you know, go ahead and trim your lavender up now, but don't do it too much later or else it won't bloom in the spring, and that would be so sad.
Indeed. So look at all your perennials and just Google and find out when's a good time. And a lot of them are right now.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
This month, next month is cut them back and they're robust growing.
Yeah. And you can tell if you're just out in the garden and you're not sure, if you see a perennial that has a lot of basal growth, new basal growth, then that's one that, you know, you can cut those old flowering stems back to the new basal growth. So the plant will kind of tell you. The Buddleia doesn't have that basal growth next to the ground. It has the growth, you know, down at the bottom of the stems. So that kind of tells you that you need to leave some of the stems so that it can create new growth from that.
Wow. Well, believe it or not, we only have about 5 minutes left.
Oh, okay.
There's a few things. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, can I talk about azaleas and camellias?
Yes.
Because this is an important time of year.
I know. That's why I was good.
Oh, I'm glad you reminded me.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I get going and then we forget to talk about things. So azaleas and camellias, and these are the Japonica camellias. There are two kinds of camellias, Sasanqua and Japonica. The Sasanqua camellias bloom in the fall. So the ones that bloom in January are the Japonicas, January, February. So now is a great time to go to the nursery if you want to add the Japonica camellias or the azaleas to your garden, because they're all in bloom this time of year. And so you want to go and pick out the colors, because the rest of the time when they're not in bloom, you know, all you have is leaves and you can't really... I mean, you might know it's pink, but...
What color pink?
What kind of pink?
What hue
pink?
Yeah.
You might not know, you know, some of the azaleas have those giant flowers, and some of them have more modest flowers. Some of them have, you know, kind of a real ruffly shape to the flower, and others have, you know, more of a flatter shape to the flower. So it's a great time to go. Besides, it's just fun to go look at them anyway in the nursery. And...
nurseries have a lot of them.
They
oh,
do.
It's January is a beautiful time to go
well,
look.
Well, and because in January, how much is blooming in your garden? Maybe not a lot,
yeah,
you know.
It's nice to have something blooming in your yard in January.
Yeah. So go to the garden centers or the nurseries, look at the azaleas and Japonica camellias, and choose the ones that you like. The Japonicas especially, oh my gosh, their flowers always look fake. They can be 6 inches across and bright red or bright pink, and They're just stunning.
Stunning. There's so many choices. Oh, my goodness.
So many choices. And actually, the japonicas, you know, I was driving up in Pasadena this fall, and they must have been the plant to plant back in the day, because those Pasadena gardens have tons of camellias. And they are so tall. You know, they climb up the walls of these houses.
Oh, yeah.
And if you go up in January and see them in bloom, it's just stunning. But what I think is one of the reasons they were planted is I think they actually are a little bit, not drought tolerant, but can do with a little less water than some of our other, you know, super water hungry plants. The one thing about most of the camellias and azaleas is that they won't like hot afternoon sun. But a lot of our houses are planted so close together that we have a lot of partly shady areas. So these are great plants for those partly shady areas.
And they're wonderful for the fall and for the January. You know, nothing, like you said, nothing's blooming. There you go.
Yeah. So consider that if you have some partly shady areas that you would like to get some colorful plants in January.
And there's only one more thing I want to talk about real quickly.
Okay.
You could still plant your natives.
Yes, yes. We've been talking about this every month since October. In October, we told you not to plant them, but wait till November. November was actually, we kind of think, the best month, because then you capture all of the rainfall that we might get. But January is still a good month to plant natives. February will be still good. After that, you can still do it in March and April, but then your poor little guys are not going to get much cool weather before the summer comes. And we really want them in the winter time to absorb all of that natural rainfall,
and
get their roots established.
And they're natives, and that's when they grow, is the winter time. So you're going to go into the dormant season in the summertime. So you really want to get them going and get some structure underneath them before the summer hits.
Absolutely. And then the last thing that I'll mention super quick is this is the month to put down a pre-emergent on your grass if you had a lot of crabgrass last year, which I did, and I always forget the pre-emergent. So this year, my husband told me to put it on his calendar, and he promised he would do it. And you can go to your nursery, since we don't have a lot of time, and ask them for a pre-emergent. An organic pre-emergent is made out of corn, a corn product. So if you want an organic one, be sure and ask for that. Otherwise, I think a lot of them are synthetic pre-emergents, but I'm going to do it this year because I don't want to. I handpicked a lot of crabgrass out of my lawn this year. Yes, I do still have lawn, but I'm very stingy with the water.
Yes, and you can have lawn.
Yes.
If you're just wise.
Yeah, if you're very wise.
I still have lawn, and I'm still in my approved level of water.
Me too. Katrina and I did experiments and took our water down to where it all started turning brown, and it still lived. So.
I turned it up, and I'm like, I can't believe how much I could really have if I wash my wall. This time of year, make sure your sprinklers, watch the time on your sprinklers, and, you know, you don't have as much daylight, and you don't need as much water, so this is when a lot of times people get caught because they're still watering. So you don't need as much in the wintertime.
And if we knock wood, get rain this month, flip that button on your sprinklers to turn off your sprinkler system.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Because it's actually bad for your plants if you continue to water them. You're risking getting some fungal diseases in your soil if you give it too much water. So,
with that being said, I think we're there.
There we are. Well, Happy New Year, everyone. Hope you get some new plants in your garden, get your garden tidied up, and plant some seeds so you have cool stuff for the spring.
Indeed, and until next month or next week, we will be talking to you soon, and have a joyous beginning of the year.